Under siege in Syria, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A young mother in eastern Ghouta in Syria describes life there as residents crowd into shelters to escape the war.
We are living underground now, and the buildings are destroyed over our heads. I don't know what is going to happen next.
Also, why some people in Mexico aren't happy with NAFTA either.
Mexico's main expectation from NAFTA was that it would become the engine of growth for the economy, and it didn't.
Plus, a problem with the power grid in Kosovo sets clocks back all over Europe.
This could be as much as 6 minutes in some places, so that's enough to miss a train.
You don't want to miss those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. Bringing you the news out of Syria is not easy. For the past couple of days, we've been trying to get through to people living in eastern Ghouta. That's a suburb of the capital, Damascus. You've probably seen pictures of the destruction in eastern Ghouta that the war has brought about. Lack of power, people reduced to primitive living conditions. The kind of thing that puts your own problems in perspective. It also makes reaching people there very hard. You can find some residents of eastern Ghouta who are posting on social media. Even then, it's not easy to verify the information they're posting. But we did manage to connect with 24-year-old Maram on WhatsApp. She asked that we only use her first name. For weeks now, Maram's been sleeping in an underground shelter with her 3-year-old son, Ahmad, and his 8-month-old brother, Omar.
We are living underground now. We are in the shelters since 20 days or more in the shelters. We are afraid from the chemical. All the poisonous gases are dangerous, especially if we are in the shelters. Now the shelters are very crowded. We are around 150. The regime is trying to reach here. They are trying to reach here to kill us all. When we get out of the shelter, we didn't know our neighborhood. It was very different. In my house, all the doors and windows are broken. We don't know why they are targeting us. All the buildings, it's all residential. It's not for any kind of weapons or warehouses. It's for living. It's for just children, women, because all of them, they are from the region, from our area. They are our relatives, our cousins. They are not from another countries. They are trying to defend us. The situation around us is very difficult. It's disastrous. Our streets are completely empty, and the shops are closed, and most of them are destroyed. The rebels are everywhere. So I have 2 children. The elder is Ahmad. He is 3 years old. And Omar, he is 8 months. He is crying so much. And Ahmad too is crying. The rockets are now are bigger and stronger. And the buildings are destroyed over our heads. We are still alive until now. I don't know what is going to happen on us next.
Some of eastern Ghouta's youngest residents have actually been posting to their own social media feeds. 11-year-old Noor and her 8-year-old sister Ala made this video plea to UN Ambassador Nikki Haley.
Dear Ambassador Nikki Haley, we are Noor and Ala from East Ghouta. Today was very difficult day here in East Ghouta. More than 200 attacks here in Ghouta. We are sitting under the blankets. We can't go out. We ask you to save the children of Ghouta. Save Ghouta, please.
The sisters live with their mother, who asked me to use only her first name, Shams. I reached her on a shaky line and asked how her children are coping.
Oh my God, you can't imagine how they are feeling now. They are very scared all the time. on the crank or sitting under the blanket. Yeah. Are all they... the time, Mom, we need food, we need food. What can I do? There is no food here.
You know, there are some critics who say that you're exploiting your daughters for propaganda, that you're telling them what to say. How do you reply to those critics?
We don't lie. This is the situation here in East Ghouta. This is our life.
Shams, really. what do you tell your daughters about the bombing, but also what you see as a lack of response from the international community? How do you explain that to them?
We need to reach our voice to the world to help us.
Is there a safe opportunity to leave Ghouta? And if there is, will you go?
If we will try to go out, they will kill us.
So you're not going to leave Ghouta then?
I hope to leave to Europe or America if we can, but we couldn't. We are living in fear.
Shams, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for your efforts.
The voices of several residents of Eastern Ghouta, Maram, Noor, and Shams. At their request, we've used only their first names. Lubna Murray is in touch with many other civilians who live in Eastern Ghouta. Lubna is Syrian, but now lives in New York City, where she's a photographer and writer. I asked her what she's hearing from Ghouta residents hiding in those underground shelters.
Every time they hear a bombing or every time they hear a shelling, they feel like this is their last minute. And I've been there in that situation. I covered Aleppo and I covered Idlib between 2012 and 2014. And I can assure you that being in that situation is just exhausting. And sometimes people just like become so numb to the idea of death. And it's just scary that in 10 years, if the world like stopped and asked, okay, why we didn't do anything to stop this insanity, no one could say, oh, well, we didn't know about it. No, you knew. And this is the biggest problem in Ghouta, that everyone knows what is going on, but no one is able to stop it. Sadly, I mean, like, for me, it's really hard to say, but I feel that the same scenario of East Aleppo will be repeated in Ghouta. And I know this is something that many Syrians will be probably not happy with hearing, but I think like the Syrian government is leaving no choice.
And when you say the same scenario as Aleppo, explain what you mean.
I mean that when people were like forced to be moved, to be evacuated from East Aleppo to Idlib. And this is sad because you either support the Syrian government or you're forced to flee. Mm-hmm. Like you're forced to change your city.
So could you envision residents of Eastern Ghouta getting on those green buses and being taken away to someplace that's safe in the north, for example?
I am not there and I cannot really speak on behalf of them, but I think many people are refusing to leave. This explains why this military campaign is entering its 20th day, because people are not surrendering and they don't want to leave. I know that's lots and lots and lots of people, they don't want to leave. Like, this is their city, after all. Al-Ghouta, for those who don't know, it was built by its people. And it's mainly farmers, and they don't want to go. And for many of them, dying there is way better than being moved to a completely new place that they don't know.
Lubna, I know there isn't a simple answer to this question, but 7 years on from the start of demonstrations against Assad, why do you think extremist rebels are the face of the Syrian opposition today? Like, the moderate voices seem to have all but disappeared.
First of all, let me disagree with you. I don't think the radicals are the face of the Syrian struggle. I think, yes, although there is radical groups, although there is extremist groups, there are still people who are resisting both groups. I mean, like both the Assad government and those radical groups. But I think, sadly, we see that in every brutal conflict. Those radical groups, they're extremists. They will have a ground to grow. Okay, but I think the first and the main reason why those groups were able to grow in Syria is the brutality of the Syrian government and the horrors that those people saw from this brutal regime. But still, again, still after all of this, after 7 years, we still see people who are willing to fight against those radicals. And it doesn't mean that those people don't exist. They do exist.
Lubna Murray, a Syrian photographer and writer, now living in New York City. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
The scene in eastern Ghouta is terrible. It's now getting a lot of attention, just like the siege of Aleppo did in 2016. At that time, the international community failed to notice violence taking place elsewhere, in particular a rebel siege taking place on a location loyal to the government of Bashar al-Assad in Idlib province. Civilian casualties there were not as bad as they were in Aleppo, but still pretty severe. So what are we missing elsewhere in Syria this time around? Amr Al-Azam teaches Middle Eastern history at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Let's start with these locations in Idlib, Fuwa and Kafria, all very close to one another in northwest Syria near Turkey. They're still under siege, right?
Yes. I mean, these are considered to be regime loyal areas, and they've been under siege now for several years, although there have been efforts to sort of negotiate different situations with regards to getting food, aid, etc. in them. So the situation is not quite as dire in any way, shape or form as down in the south, say, in the areas that are besieged by the regime in Ghouta or elsewhere.
So that's one spot. Where else in Syria are government and rebel forces fighting each other right now?
Really, it's been relatively quiet in the last few months. For the regime to be able to launch simultaneous major offensives against Idlib, against remaining pockets of ISIS in the east, around Deir ez-Zor, and against the southern front, all at the same time, they just don't have that kind of manpower available, all the resources available to that.
So for the most part, it's the government of Bashar al-Assad fighting rebel forces. What about ISIS? You mentioned them. I mean, do they have any organized forces in the field anymore?
Well, it seems that they still hold some territory east of the Euphrates River, sort of east and south of Deir ez-Zor. And they also seem to have some areas or pockets on the western side of the Euphrates River. For the most part, it seems that the regime has almost ceased, effectively ceased any operations against ISIS. The SDF, that's the Kurdish-dominated forces backed by the United States, certainly there were plenty of operations being conducted there against ISIS, but those have all but ceased now because of the ongoing Turkish offensive against the canton of Afrin in the western, northwestern Syria.
Right, the Turkish army has been attacking Kurdish forces.
Yes. And so,
how's that going?
Well, initially it was hard work for the Turks, but it seems in the last week, 10 days, that they've pushed even further and deeper into Afrin, causing enough concern, it appears, to the Kurds that they've now, the last 48 hours, they've not only decided to halt operations against ISIS, but they've also shifted a significant number of forces, about 1,700 fighters, from their ISIS operations, which were being conducted with U.S. support, back to Afrin to help stem this deteriorating situation, military situation, as far as they are concerned. In fact, I believe a couple of days ago, the U.S. even announced that they were halting anti-ISIS operations whilst this situation is resolved.
Amr, you're from Syria. You've long been a member of the opposition to Bashar al-Assad. I mean, this situation can't be what your opposition was hoping for. What are your feelings on this conflict after 7 years of violence?
I suppose, obviously, where we are today is nothing like what we had hoped for back in those heady days of 2011 and 2012. Unfortunately, what we have today is very different. It's very sad, and, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. It is what it is now.
Amr Al-Azam at Shawnee State University. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. White House advisor Jared Kushner flew to Mexico today for a meeting with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto. Kushner's trip comes 2 weeks after Peña Nieto canceled a trip to the United States following a testy phone call with Kushner's father-in-law, that would be President Trump. Economic issues like the North American Free Trade Agreement are always at the top of the U.S.-Mexico agenda, especially since Trump's been calling for NAFTA to be revamped or canceled since his days on the campaign trail. Carlos Heredia is an associate professor at the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics in Mexico City. Just remind us how Mexico stands to lose if NAFTA ends or is changed dramatically.
It will be a major blow to the Mexican economy. You know, back in 1994, when the negotiations wrapped up and NAFTA went into effect, the Mexican leadership saw NAFTA as a point of arrival. We had joined the major leagues, and our economy could be put on automatic pilot and work smoothly. And it so happens that we didn't do our domestic homework. So the rate of growth, even during the 25 years of NAFTA, has been rather low, hovering around 2%.
Let me just jump in there. What do you mean by domestic homework?
Well, we didn't do reforms that would have led to anti-corruption, the end of impunity. So whatever structural reforms we did in energy, education, etc., the implementation always was faced with a corrupt political system. Mexico's main expectation from NAFTA was that it would become the engine of growth for the economy, and it didn't. When you have half of the population under the poverty line, when you have deliberate policies to suppress wages, when you bet on economic growth based on exports and you neglect your domestic market, then it's not going to happen.
So what's going to change in that arena if there's some renegotiation for NAFTA?
Not much, because we are not betting for the future. You know, we're not investing on our human capital. We're not adopting and implementing new technologies. But most of all, we are only catering to the needs of the exporters and the top economic elite, rather than making NAFTA an instrument for inclusion that would spur domestic growth.
So we know how President Enrique Peña Nieto feels about Donald Trump and a lot of his policies, but things are more complicated now because the election is coming up in Mexico. And by July, because Peña Nieto can't run again, there will be a new president. How important has trade been as an issue during the campaign?
Trade is not really a campaign issue. The relationship between the president of Mexico and the president of the United States is an enormous issue. I think the bilateral relationship is at a low point right now. Trump has been uttering insults to Mexico and Mexicans for the last 2 years, and that doesn't go without a consequence. In fact, right now we're experiencing a very, very low point in the bilateral relationship, and it will be very difficult to recover from that. I don't see that there would be any major shift in trade policy, regardless of who is elected president of Mexico on July 1st. I don't see any candidate denouncing NAFTA. On the contrary, I do see President Trump likely to denounce NAFTA and pull the United States out of the agreement.
So White House advisor Jared Kushner is in Mexico today to meet with President Nieto. Can constructive discussion about trade and economics even happen, like right now, if it's overshadowed by this poor relationship between Peña Nieto and Trump?
You know, pretty much everyone in Mexico is seeing Trump's announcement of tariffs on the imports of aluminum and steel as an extortion, as a blackmail. Either you do what I say you need to do on NAFTA and you behave well and you give me what I need, or I'm going to pull out the United States of this agreement and tell my voters that Canada and Mexico weren't up to the task. Unless that changes, and I don't see it changing from the White House, the discussions today won't lead to much.
If Trump succeeds in changing NAFTA in a major way, how will Mexico respond? Will it put tariffs in place?
Yes. Our Secretary of Commerce has said exactly that. We'll just respond in kind. We've done that before. We did it on road transportation, targeting districts that are Republican districts with Trump voters. So it will be a very sophisticated operation in terms of electoral districts. It will not be only a trade response, but it will be a political response.
Carlos Heredia, an associate professor at the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics in Mexico City. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's an advertising war going on in London right now. Billboards and electronic messages around the city are welcoming the arrival of His Excellency, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. The prince has a friendly smile, a handsome face. The man looks charming. But there's another message on some of London's iconic double-decker buses. It shows a picture of the Crown Prince and the words, "I am a war criminal." We had to find out what was going on, so we got in touch with a member of the British Parliament this afternoon.
Hello, can you hear me?
The Right Honourable Andrew Mitchell explained that all of this has to do with the war in Yemen. Mitchell is not happy about what the Saudis are doing in Yemen, but he approves of the Crown Prince meeting with Britain's Prime Minister.
Saudi Arabia is an important ally of both Britain and America. And as friends, we trade together, we work together on security matters. That's very important. But of course, friends should also be honest and candid with each other. And we should be very clear that what is happening in the Yemen at the moment is appalling in human rights terms and is also counterproductive in terms of Saudi Arabia's security. So I'm very glad he's here, and I hope that our Prime Minister won't hold back in giving him that very tough message.
Mitchell says that tough message to the Crown Prince will be, one, stop killing civilians in violation of humanitarian law. Two, open up all of Yemen's ports to fuel and food and medical aid. And three, move from fighting a war to negotiating a peace through the United Nations. We talked about that, and then I asked Mitchell what he thought his American counterparts, our senators and representatives, should say to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman when he comes to Washington later this month.
Well, I think we should all of us be focusing on the humanitarian catastrophe that is affecting Yemen today, on the enormous number of innocent civilians who have died. And I've just been watching, you know, the wonderful Vietnam War made by Ken Burns and Novak, which your PBS has been screening.
Right,
and
Novak.
It shows you that it's entirely impossible to win a war in the sort of territory that Yemen is from the air, which is what the Saudis are effectively trying to do. The lessons and learnings from what happened in Vietnam, where, after all, your country deployed over 500,000 troops, is that they simply won't win.
I mean, that's a lesson that has been learnable many times since Vietnam, and few people seem to learn it. You think it's going to be learnable this time?
Well, I think that if I was to meet the Saudi prince, which I'm not on the occasion of this visit, I would give him a copy of the that absolutely brilliant program by Burns and Novak. And perhaps one of your senators, when they see him in America, might give him that very present so that he can watch it and learn from the conclusions at his leisure.
Yes, a DVD of the PBS series of Vietnam War, a pick by British Member of Parliament Andrew Mitchell for the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. I'm Marco Werman. A top Russian lawmaker is accused of sexual harassment by a number of female journalists. The response from his male colleagues? Laughter and jokes.
One of them was saying, well, you know, like, I bet I could harass two lady journalists at the same time, you know, stuff like that. So, like, they're not taking this seriously at all.
Me Too meets the Duma. That story is still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Me Too in Russia. That's a thing, or could be, maybe. A prominent legislator stands accused of sexually harassing women journalists. At least five reporters have accused this man, Leonid Slutsky, of verbal harassment, forced kissing, and groping. The response from Russia's Speaker of the House? If you feel unsafe in Parliament, change jobs. Not the response they were probably looking for. Natalia Antonova is a writer and journalist. And Natalia, you're based in New York now, but had been in Russia for some years and had been reporting there. Break down for us the cast of characters here, and what are the accusers saying?
Well, so Leonid Slutsky is a pretty powerful man in the Duma, you know, as much as one can be powerful in the Duma, because we all know that the real political power is in the Kremlin. But, you know, there are these men in the Duma who are movers and shakers, and he's generally considered to be one of them. And I believe that this entire scandal started with one anonymous accusation, and then more women came forward to say that he had groped them, kissed them, and was also verbally harassing them. So Vyacheslav Volodin, the speaker, in a very predictable turn of events, he makes it about the women and not about the men actually harassing them. And I should also note that last week, they were speaking about this case in the Duma, and basically they were all laughing about it. Like, all the men present there, including Leonid Slutsky himself, were cracking jokes. And one of them was saying, well, you know, like, I bet I can out harass you. I bet I can harass two lady journalists at the same time, you know, stuff like that. So, like, they're not taking this seriously at all.
How widespread is this kind of behavior generally across Russia?
Well, we have to consider that Russia is, in some ways, it's a conservative society. In other ways, it's a hypersexualized society. And the hyper-masculine and the hyper-feminine are the two ideals. Like, that is the norm. And I can tell you that as a woman who worked as a journalist in Russia for a very long time, I've had encounters with Russian officials that were flirtatious. And some of this is harmless. Some of this is just harmless flirting. And it happens a lot on the job. And it's sometimes it crosses into this territory where there's harassment and danger involved, of course. And the problem is that as a woman, when you're encountering this, you're always at a disadvantaged position, of course, because men are so much more powerful in Russia. And it's something that you're always negotiating, this power dynamic. You're negotiating it every day as a woman, and particularly as a woman journalist.
Natalia, as you know, Russia's got presidential elections coming up on March 18th. And the House Speaker said the timing of these accusations from these five reporters is suspicious. Do you have any thoughts on why now? And how much do you think has that's been triggered by the Me Too movement in other parts of the world?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think that Russian women are paying attention to what's happening in other parts of the world. In fact, as I often have to remind people, Russians pay attention to the rest of the world much more than Americans, for example, do. They see what's happening in other countries. They see what's happening in America. And of course, naturally, they're going to respond to it. But at the same time, you know, oftentimes one woman says something and then other women feel a little bit safer in just coming out. And then, of course, it snowballs. And naturally, whenever something like this happens, establishment politicians in Russia are going to accuse you of participating in a foreign plot, you know, because everything that goes wrong in Russia is a foreign imperialist plot. Let's
right.
just say it, because it's true. That's how they always spin it.
In the U.S., the Me Too movement started with a flood of accusations against Harvey Weinstein. I know you've had some experience with Russia's film industry. And last year you wrote an article saying that what happened with the Weinstein allegations could never happened in Russia. So explain that.
Well, the thing about it is that it comes down to an issue of solidarity. So I was obviously I was part of the movie scene in Russia for years, and I worked as a producer. When the Weinstein thing happened and the Kevin Spacey thing happened, I was just paying attention to my friends in the Russian film industry, which is, of course, much smaller and much more insulated. But it's also it's a much more down-to-earth industry. Like, these people are not like gods on Mount Olympus. They're like real people you meet in real life and you hang out with them. And a lot of like my producer friends and a lot of my writer friends, like film writer friends, just listening to them talk about this and seeing their posts on social media, it was so disheartening in a way because they
Why?
Were saying,
what
well,
were they saying?
Well, they were saying, for example, that, you know, like if an actress wants to sleep with someone to get a role, why shouldn't she? That's not coercion. You know, they weren't even talking like to them, like the rape aspect of it wasn't even registering. Or they were saying, well, you know, I'm a man and I work in the film industry and I like women. I'm not allowed to hit on women anymore. And like, you're going to ruin my, you know, it was just like they really what they were doing is that they were conflating harassment and coercion and force, use of force with like love and affection and flirting and affirmation.
So with the Me Too movement making front page news all over the globe, do you think it could really take off in Russia?
At the moment, no. I really don't think so. I mean, I think that it's going to be interesting to see how late Putinism impacts, you know, social dynamics and gender dynamics in Russia, because Putin is going to get reelected. But also it's talk to any like analyst or observer is that, yeah, we do see like a waning of Putin's rule. We do see the Russian elites already scrambling to figure out what comes next. And nobody knows what comes next, really. And I feel like I do want to say that, you know, history in Russia slows down and speeds up very rapidly at times. And I think we could see a speeding up. We could see something very dramatic take place with that down the road. But right now, like, you know, sitting here in March of 2018, I don't know when that might occur.
I mean, there is a woman running against Putin, Ksenia Sobchak. A lot of people say mm-hmm. that she's kind of a decoy candidate. But is she a harbinger of that drama to come?
She might be. She's a very interesting person. I would say that she's a complex character. I think that she's trying very hard to not appear too feminist, to be honest. But what will happen to her down the line, I don't know. I mean, she is charismatic, and we will just have to watch the space and see what happens. Let's put it this way. I'm not writing her off.
Writer and journalist Natalia Antonova joining us from New York. Thanks very much, as always, Natalia.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Well, maybe things were better for women back in the old days of the Soviet Union. I'm thinking specifically of Valentina Tereshkova, who turned 81 this week. That name may not mean much to you, but her place in the history of the Soviet space program is huge. In 1963, Tereshkova was the first female cosmonaut in space, preceding Sally Ride, the first American woman in space, by two decades. My BBC colleague Lucy Ash takes us back to that historic moment.
On a crackly connection from zero gravity, Valentina Tereshkova announced her radio call sign to anxious listeners on Earth. I am Chaika, she said repeatedly. I am Chaika, the Russian word for seagull. This sturdy 26-year-old with blue eyes and plump cheeks was the first woman in outer space. On the 16th of June 1963, in her orange spacesuit, grey boots and helmet stamped with the letters USSR, she squeezed into Vostok 6, a 2.5-metre capsule, and was shot into orbit, adding yet another first to the Soviet space race after the first satellite, the first animal and the first man. In an interview she gave in 1977, Tereshkova was careful to share the credit for her achievement.
When a cosmonaut goes into space, he or she knows very well that it's not their work alone. There are thousands of workers who made the capsule, thousands of designers, engineers, doctors and other scientists who prepared them for the flight.
As a young girl, Tereshkova was fascinated by speed and movement. She once said she envied the engine drivers and wished she could be in their place, driving trains across the world. As a teenager, she looked to the skies and joined a parachute club.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is the news. All Moscow is waiting to give a hero's welcome to the world's first spaceman, Major Gagarin of the Soviet Air Force.
After Yuri Gagarin, the first man to return from space in 1961, Tereshkova wrote to the authorities begging to be sent into space. It was a long shot. She was a factory worker. But the Central Committee was eager to find proletarian heroes. Agents from the space program secretly came to watch her parachute jumps, and then she was invited to Moscow for cosmonaut training. But she wasn't alone.
Valentina Tereshkova, Zhanna Yorkina,
Valentina Ponomaryova was one of the cosmonauts who trained alongside Tereshkova.
There were five of us. At first we were a bit guarded, but soon we were spending more time together. We all lived in the same complex, we trained together, we ate our meals together and did everything together.
In some ways it sounds like a cross between the army and a holiday camp.
There was a piano in the canteen and all the cosmonauts would gather around in the evening. We were full of enthusiasm. We loved singing together, especially the new songs relating to space exploration.
On the 19th of November 1962, selection for the flights took place. The two Valentinas, Ponomaryova and Tereshkova, were the final candidates. But who would be the first Soviet woman in space? Ideology trumped expertise when it came to the final choice. Tereshkova mouthed her support for the party, and her daughter Yelena now admits that her fresh face caught the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev's eye.
She was just a Soviet girl, which works at the factory, and that is why maybe she won.
Is it true that Khrushchev liked the way she looked?
And this is also one of the factors. She liked very much Jacqueline Kennedy, and maybe she compared them together.
You mean she modelled herself on Jackie Kennedy?
Jackie Kennedy, yes.
Poor Valentina Ponomaryova may have had the best test results, but she failed to impress the selection board. When asked, "What do you want from life?" she replied, "I want to take everything it can offer." Ponomaryova still can't hide her disappointment at being passed over.
It was a terrible moment when Tereshkova took off and we were left behind. They told us, "Don't fret, you'll all get the chance to go to space." We clung on to that hope for a very long time.
It makes you upset even now, all these years later.
Of course, that was putting it mildly. It seemed that my life was suddenly over. There was nothing else to live for.
Back in 1963, a British TV programme called What's New featured pictures from inside Tereshkova's space capsule.
And there is a pencil floating around, the pencil on which she makes notes on her pad, floating about in space. There it goes, out of the top of your screen.
Tereshkova's conversation from space with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev was broadcast around the world. Contact with ground control was intermittent during Tereshkova's 3 days in space. There were reports of problems. The mission controlled from back on Earth had to be modified. At the time, Tereshkova vehemently denied oversleeping, but later admitted to it. She also denies vomiting in the capsule, although these days nausea is recognised as a common reaction to space conditions.
She also did become quite ill, didn't she? The space food didn't agree with her.
No. It was not truth.
These come from the memoirs of some of the people involved in the first space programme. And why would they make stuff up?
My mother told me about those people, and I myself also read these articles. And she told me people were very jealous, and it was very complicated times.
After 3 days in space, it was time for her return. At 7 kilometres above ground, she was catapulted out of the capsule, still stuck in the ejection chair. At 4 kilometres up, the parachute opened. I asked Yelena what her mother had told her about the moment she fell to Earth.
First of all, she was noticed by the peasants who lived near. And they run to her spaceship and start to touch her. Oh, you're alive. Oh, you're so interesting. And what is it? And my mother showed them the food.
She let them taste her special space food.
Taste the special food because it is, for those people, it was very interesting. And my mother told me about very, very old woman. She asked my mother, "Oh, daughter, you was in space. Did you see God there? Because you were very, very high." But my mother told her, "Unfortunately, no."
She was given a triumphant reception in Moscow after the flight. As she strode along a red carpet in white high heels, people called her Cinderella of the Stars and Gagarin in a skirt. After Tereshkova's somewhat faltering speech, she got a massive bear hug from Khrushchev before she was allowed to move along to a tiny stooped woman in a headscarf, her weeping mother. After the flight, Khrushchev organized a state wedding between Valentina and fellow cosmonaut Andriy Nikolaev. They divorced 19 years later when Yelena had grown up. But after Valentina's inspirational flight, her trail turned to cinders. It was 20 years before another woman was sent into orbit. And up until now, there have only been 3 Russian women in space.
That's Lucy Ash reporting there for the BBC's Witness program. In a moment, back porch fiddling from West Africa and Sudan. First, though, a quick news note from Europe, and one that seems relevant with this big storm slamming the East Coast today. Some of us may lose power tonight, and that means resetting some clocks tomorrow. Funny thing, Europe's Electric Power Transmission Authority is also warning consumers to reset their clocks. Turns out that bedside alarm clocks from Spain to Turkey might be running slow. Please bear with me here. This will all make sense in a moment. Regulators say there's been a drop in electric power generation in Kosovo, and neighboring Serbia is refusing to make up the difference. My BBC colleague Mike Sanders explains.
Well, Kosovo's withholding, Serbia's refusing to take up the slack because, of course, Serbia has never recognized the independence Kosovo declared unilaterally from Serbia 10 years ago, so why should it help out? The consequence is that the overall pressure in the grid, if you like, is affected. You've got to keep up a constant balance between the supply and demand to keep up this oscillation of 50 hertz, which is the frequency that alternating current works on. If you have an imbalance, if you provide too much, then you get more than the 50 hertz and things start to run fast. If you don't provide enough, then things start to slow down because you haven't got enough power to power them for their design. Everything is designed in Europe to work on 50 hertz. In things like their oven clocks, their bedside alarms, anything that actually plugs directly into the grid, they will be seeing the thing losing time. And the central authority, ENTSO-E, says this could be as much as 6 minutes in some places. So that's enough to miss a train.
Wow. Mike Sanders there. He's the BBC's Europe regional editor. By the way, computers and smartphones are not affected by the power problems. But just to be safe, maybe get that wind-up watch out. And speaking of time, let's get straight to this next story. Here's another A-side, B-side from the world's Brandy Fullwood.
The fiddle doesn't have a simple history. It's not something you can really generalize. Okay, you could, but I'm not going to. The instrument has been adapted by different countries, ethnicities, territories, and over time it's come into new styles and meanings for each group or person. This A-side B-side is taking a chunk of that history and digging into some intended and unintended similarities. On the A-side, here's a 1958 Smithsonian recording by anthropologist Stanley Diamond. It's a collection of music of the Jos Plateau and other regions in Nigeria. On the ninth track, three musicians are heard playing drums, singing, playing the bugle, and the fiddle. In the first minutes, Tiv musicians settle into this round of singing. Their voices flood into one another and grasp the ends, beginning a new round until fading into the drums again. The drumming is steady and the voices seem to slide right over the rhythm. It's such an in-the-body sound, like tossing hips. Eventually, the recording breaks into the fiddle medley. The style of singing becomes much more narrative in its pacing and tone. The fiddle is faint, but stirring under the spoken word. In between cantations, the fiddler shifts into plucking and slapping the string. There's a very physical relationship to the instrument itself. With the B-side, the influence is literal. Sudan Archives is a self-taught violinist and vocalist. She is heavily inspired by Sudanese and West African fiddlers.
I just started to research African fiddle music, and I looked up Sudanese fiddling because my mom nicknamed me Sudan, and I saw that they were playing the actual violins, but just the style was just totally different. So cool. In Sudan, I noticed that sometimes they'll play the violin by their heart. They won't put it on their shoulder. They'll play it a little lower. And Western classical music, you're not really singing. In Sudan, they play the violin and then they have a microphone right there and they're singing at the same time, and sometimes they're singing and playing. And I was like, whoa, this is so cool. How do they do so many things at once?
You can hear that fullness in her songs like Oatmeal or Water. In Water, there's this physicality where water becomes an object.
I was just singing and then I just pitched it down, and then it just sounded like a really, really crazy bass line. I was like, oh, that's cool. I'm going to keep that.
The song is cool and cloudy but dense, like your ear is gulping down a mineral-packed glass of water. But then there's this interaction with water, like smacking it. And here Sudan isn't sampling water or using a water drum. She's clapping in between playing the violin.
And then the clapping was just me clapping, but the violin F-holes were picking up the claps. So they kind of sound a little muffled, because I didn't record it through a microphone, I recorded through the violin.
Like the A-side, Sudan Archive's Water has a sound that lifts with the rhythm, collecting and grasping onto voices, looping them back and forth. Her voice layers in like a relay race. It extends further and eventually dives off into this basket of strings. Both of these tracks on the A-side and the B-side have this soulfulness to them. The musicians embody and explore their instruments. New textures layer in from strings and personal grooves. Sudan's still experimenting with her strings, but when she began playing, her violin teachers weren't really into this idea.
You play very uncontrollably, and your bow, the way you hold it, it's not straight. And if you play like this, it'll sound cleaner. And I was like, oh, well, I'm going to try to do it this way and learn it this way just because. But I feel like the way I'm doing it, when I'm scratching it, when I'm bowing, I feel like that's my style.
And it's not that she has anything against classical violin.
It's good to learn that style because you can be well-rounded, but maybe the way that I play, that's my own style that I'm making.
For the World, I'm Brandy Fullwood.
Nice sounds. Brandy's story is part of Future Folk, a collaboration between The World and Smithsonian Folkways. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Hope you'll make it back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.